Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts and we're discussing 1964 in the work of master cartoonist Charles M. Schulz. Hope you guys are all doing well out there. I'm your host for the day. I'm Jimmy Gownley. You might know me from my comic book series, Amelia Rules, or my graphic novel, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, or The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright and a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He co-created the very first comic book price guide, was the original editor for Amelia Rules, and is the cartoonist behind Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells, Mr. Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, as well as the creator of the Instagram comic strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
All right, guys, we are at 1964. You know, Beatlemania is in full swing. We're well into the 60s now, and we're reaching the point in Peanuts that is really my favorite, absolute pinnacle stuff. I'm just really, really loving all the cartooning I'm getting to see this year. And I can't wait to talk to you guys about it. Harold, what do you think about 1964?
To me, these are the peak Peanuts that I grew up with. So I have a real fondness for this era. And like you said, I mean, there's a lot going on in the world at this time. The JFK assassination was on November 22nd of the previous year. So you're going to start to see that right at the beginning of these strips. If there's any discernible, you know, response directly or indirectly to that, this is the time. And then, as you said, Peanuts also was happening during this Beatles invasion of the United States. And that was, what, February 9th when they were on the Ed Sullivan show? So it's... You know, it's a turbulent time, and it'll be interesting to see if we see any of that in the strips this year. And the kids update, we're ages 6 to 14 right now. Perfect time to get a lot of amazing material, possibly inspired by being around kids all the time. And 64 is also the year that I think Schulz got his second Reuben Award. And that was the first cartoonist to get two Reuben Awards, but he richly deserves it here. And the other milestone or kind of interesting thing that I think kind of propelled his career forward a little bit was that Robert Short's Gospel According to Peanuts came out through John Knox Press, and I think it was in its 15th printing by the end of 1966. So he's being noticed outside of the normal channels for comics, and a lot of people are talking about Peanuts in this era. It's really, really picking up. He is a cultural phenomenon at this point.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see, because at this point for me, because it's so baked into my consciousness, this just looks, I don't even know how I can necessarily discuss, like, say, the art. It just is, you know, this is Peanuts as I always remember it from as long as I've been alive. Michael, how about you? What are you thinking about 1964 and the strips we've read this week?
Well, part of my experience with Peanuts is getting the one volume every year that came out, the original printings. And I don't remember well, but I think I probably got them as presents. So I had every year, and it was probably like, okay, birthday present, easy to find, because they knew I loved this stuff. So I'm reading 1964 and started thinking, like, this seems a little down from last year. It didn't seem quite as funny or not as important. And, you know, in every year we've done so far, there have been maybe 6-10 strips I'd never seen before, because they didn't print everything in those books. And there was a long run of strips I'd never seen before.
Do you find, Michael, that the strips you haven't read before, is there a resonance for the ones that you have, in the sense that, like, if more of this year you haven't experienced, do you think that's a negative in terms of how you respond to it, or does it make a difference that if you remember reading it?
That's what I'm thinking now, because I started halfway through the year, I was going, oh, okay, this doesn't seem quite as funny as last year, and I don't remember seeing these before. So I suspect that I missed a book somehow. And so these were all new to me, and I'm clearly not the same person I was when I was 12 years old.
Thankfully.
I don't know.
Well, do you remember, we had this discussion. When I was a kid, I loved Spider-Man, but I loved the Steve Ditko Spider-Man, even though I did not know that was the original Spider-Man, but I liked Marvel Tales. That version of Spider-Man was the real Spider-Man to me, right? But I lived in the sticks, so I got whatever issues just happened to come through Jiffy Mart. So it was a random assortment when they reprinted those original Spider-Man comics. Years later, when they put them out in those big essential collections, I got to read all of them. And it was amazing. The ones I had as a kid, they were all the masterpieces. By dumb luck, I happened to, like, Never Step on a Scorpion, Spider-Man 29 was clearly a work of genius. Yes. Whereas, you know, number 28. And it's just the way it is. Those things, when they hit you at that time, it leaves such an imprint on you. Nothing that you're going to experience later in life can ever match that.
Do you think that has something also to do with Schultz is in the same era as you are when you're reading it for the first time. There are things happening. There's just a feel for that era, and you carry that with you. And if you don't have that and you're experiencing something that's now what's almost 60 years old, that if you don't have that memory baked into you when you're reading it, you think there's something that just is lost that it enriches the strip when you know that you were experiencing it around the time Schultz was creating it and he was making it for that time.
Yeah. Well, basically, I must have read these once, all of them, because they came in the LA Times, which we got every day. So I must have read them once. But the books, I'd read 20, 50 times.
Right.
And generally up to this point, when we're going back and reading every strip, I don't even have to read them. I know them that well. You know, I just glanced at the last panel to make sure I got the punchline right. And this, for the first time, it was whole sequences I'd never seen, which is great, but I'm not a teenager anymore. And they didn't strike me as relevant to my life as they did then. I mean, really, Peanuts defined my worldview.
Well, I think I may have spoken about this before, but the thing in my life that really reminds me of is Love and Rockets, in that Maggie, the main character in Jaime Hernandez's Mechanics stories and Locust stories, was like 3 years older than me in 1987, and she's still 3 years older than me. And I experienced all that in real time with her. But if I were now to give like my kids, hey, here's the Love and Rockets collection, they could read it in a week, and there's no way that's going to have that same resonance. It's really a magical thing when you get to experience it in real time that no other generation gets. So we're lucky in that sense.
Well, I mean, we had Peanuts and the Beatles and the Dick Van Dyke Show, at least for me.
I had none of those except
happening
Peanuts,
the same time. And the Twilight Zone.
By the way, if anyone's out there, do not sleep on the Dick Van Dyke Show. It's one of the all-time great TV comedies out there.
Absolutely.
We should start another podcast, DVD on DVD, where we go through all the Dick Van Dyke shows on DVD and the extras. That's our next podcast. there is some stuff that I thought was kind of interesting and talking about with the zeitgeist. One of you guys didn't pick any of these strips, but I thought it was interesting that he had Linus meditating and also meditating with his eyes open, which is like a Buddhist method of meditation. And 1964 seems pretty early for that. I was kind of going around to see where that would have been in the zeitgeist for Schultz to pick up. There, Alan Watts, who sort of introduced Buddhism to the West, had a book out in, I think, 62 or 63. But there really wasn't much else. I mean, Michael, do you have any recollection of that being a thing that early? I mean, obviously, in my understanding, it all comes, of course, from the Beatles, but that's partly because I can only discuss three things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was shocked to see that stuff.
Well, I remember this must have been like the late 50s, you know, coming out of my bedroom where I was locked in with my comic books, and my dad would be standing on his head. And,
okay,
you know, being a kid and not having, you know, great communication skills, I never asked him, why are you standing on your head? But he did it because he was reading Krishnamurti in the 50s. And, you know, of course, never talked about it or explained anything to us. So it was just, huh, you know, my dad eats yogurt and stands on his head.
That's the greatest. That is the most Michael thing. You would never, of course, ask. Never.
Yeah. When I read that, I was also wondering, you know, there's such a thing as Christian meditation. And because Schultz tends to be a little oblique about that stuff, particularly in this era, I didn't know which way it was when I was reading them. I was interested because it is becoming a part of the American culture. It's just getting started when it's coming from Eastern. I mean, the transcendental meditation is just getting kind of known. So, yeah, I couldn't tell where he was coming from when he was approaching this.
It was the eyes open thing that struck me. That was either a mistake, right, or not a mistake. And he really specifically knew that it was this type, you know, you'll stare at a candle or you'll just stare at a blade of grass or whatever like that. Yeah. And, you know, the Catholic version of meditation was always just the rosary, which is very different. But yeah, I thought that was really interesting because it seemed like not only was he reflecting culture back, but in that instance, he was almost a little bit ahead of it, which is also part of these things that get big. They feed off it, and it's hard to say what's leading what.
And Schultz is really well read. We know that.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen that. He has a big library of books. He's reading pretty widely from what we can tell. And so, yeah, who knows what it was that he was experiencing. He might have been getting it through his kids. Who knows? You know, it's really interesting.
Don't forget, a couple of years back, Snoopy was standing on his head in the water dish.
Oh, my gosh. That's right.
It was a long sequence, right, which was, again, kind of
did your dad read Peanuts?
Beatniky. Oh, well, yeah, he did.
So that's
it. I'm sure. I mean, we got the LA Times on page 4.
But you didn't have a water dish, so that maybe isn't.
We had a dog, so we probably had a water dish.
Oh, what was your dog name?
That was Lady at that time.
Aw. What kind of dog was Lady?
Lady was just a mutt.
Nice.
Named after Lady and the Tramp, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Classic Disney movie, where it's going to be another podcast.
Yeah, our dogs.
It's like the only Disney movie that there's like two whole versions of. They did a wide one, a widescreen one, and like a 4:3 version.
Really?
Yeah, it's straight. If you get like the last time that was released on Blu-ray or whatever, it comes with both. Completely different. It's really strange.
The backgrounds are different.
Yeah. At least extended and stuff, and the shots are then reframed. And oh yeah, it's they have a whole little documentary on it.
I remember I went for the very first day of the re-release of Lady and the Tramp in the 1980s in the theater. I think I went in the afternoon. I just walked over to a theater. There's like almost nobody there, and I think it must have been the very first showing because they hadn't changed the lens to CinemaScope, and so it was all smashed together, and I had to find the projectionist.
Yeah, that's the reason I'm living in Italy, is actually because...
This is the night, it's a beautiful night.
That was it.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
I'm excited to talk all of those 1960s. Oh, do you have something else, Michael?
No, I'm saying Peanuts. Remember that?
What?
I vaguely remember Peanuts. Peanuts is definitely a good thing. Harold, do you have any info on Mr. Schultz other than what we've covered already in 1964?
No, I kind of covered my bits there. It's a really, you know, yeah, he's hunkering down and making strips, and I'm sure he's answering more mail than he's ever answered in his life.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? Let's add to the heaps of praise he was no doubt receiving that year. And let's just get to it. We'll start off with the strips. Sound good?
Yeah.
Great.
Let's do it.
Here we go. January 11th. Lucy, Charlie Brown, and Snoopy are standing outside. Lucy says to Charlie Brown, "Do you know why dogs like people?" Lucy continues, "Because they need us so much. Without people, dogs are nothing." Snoopy's ears bolt straight up as he hears this. Then he walks away, climbs on top of his doghouse, and lying there, thinks to himself, "I thought I'd better leave before I began biting a few appropriate legs."
I just noticed, because I was kind of flipping through the strips we picked, and Snoopy's getting really hostile.
He's also getting a little bit pudge.
Little too much dinner, I think. No, there's biting going on. There's pushing people down hills. He's angry.
But he's doing it in this kind of mellow, eyes closed way now.
Yeah.
And the thing that is, I think it's particularly evident this year, like you're saying with Snoopy. I mean, I think the thing that gets me in this 1964 Snoopy is, you know, we were saying that Schultz will draw the character in the pose regardless of whether it's consistent from pose to pose because it's the right thing in the bat pose. And Snoopy on the doghouse now, look at the thickness of his neck compared to when he's just standing. He's got a tiny little pencil neck when he's sitting. But when he's on his back, his neck is, I think it's safe to say, at least 3 to 4 times bigger. It's crazy.
I've got a question for you animation buffs, because I have not seen the cartoons. Did they ever show Snoopy getting on top of the doghouse? How does he do it?
I think they would show it from behind, right? Not from behind, but rather he would go behind the doghouse and then just kind of appear on top. Was that it?
I'm drawing a blank, actually.
I can't swear to that. I'm sure someone out there knows. Josh Stauffer, are you listening? You can tell us that.
I'm sure there are people who, were like, you don't know that?
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's the podcast gets clicked off. Everyone knows that. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't watch. I don't think any of us are super familiar with all of the animated stuff. No. You know, I basically know the 60s and 70s stuff. But, yeah, you're certainly right about that with that drawing. But he gets away with it. He gets away with it by sheer force of will and just... Yeah.
And he's consistent. He's consistent in his inconsistency.
Well, yeah. And we're going to see that coming up in a couple strips, too. Oh, I should mention, before we get too far down the road here, if you're out there at home and you want to play along, you can follow these strips. You can read them all for free at gocomics.com. If that ends up being a little bit of a challenge, as technology can be sometimes, we have a little video that Liz put together on our website, teach you how to navigate it. But basically, just go to gocomics.com, type in Peanuts, type in the year 1964, a little calendar comes up, you could pick the dates and you can follow along with us. Or you can treat yourself, go out and buy those Fantagraphics books that collect the entire series, which are some of the prettiest comics ever made. Until then, we're just going to keep going right here. January 13th, Snoopy's on top of his doghouse again. He thinks to himself, I wonder if it's supper time yet. I wonder if my dish is full of food. In the next panel, he's still lying on top of the doghouse, but his eyes are all scrunched up as he thinks to himself, I hate to look and then be disappointed. It's better to wait. Who can wait? I'll look. No, I won't. I've got to look. No, I'll wait. In panel 3, he takes a quick glance at the, of course, empty supper dish. And in panel 4, he sits up on the doghouse and says, rats.
What do you think of panel 3 in this strip? What we have in this panel is you see Snoopy on his back as he's been in the first two panels. And then there is a head sticking out of the top of the head of Snoopy, looking down at the dog dish. And I was kind of surprised he did this because you have to see him looking down first. And it's essentially the second motion of him moving from back.
Right. But you're moving left to right if you're reading.
Yeah. And I was kind of surprised he did that. It's obviously clear. He's always clear. But that was just an unusual move.
I think you're right. Just put the shot of Snoopy looking down at the dog dish. That's all you need.
Yeah. Well, I think he was attempting to make it really fast.
A quick look, yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe he tried to draw Snoopy looking over the edge and he didn't like the way it looked, and so he gave the rest of the body and it's the normal pose that you're used to, lying on his back. He just couldn't find a way that worked where he edged Snoopy. Like you say, it has to be quick. And if he's now peering over the edge, I don't know. That one did read a little weird for me, and an interesting choice on his part.
Well, it was jarring, but there was an earlier attempt at doing this kind of quick motion with Snoopy. And I mean, I don't know what year it was, but it was probably 5-6 years before that we all commented on that. It didn't quite work. I think there were two of him dancing, which indicated he was like running back and forth really quick.
Yeah, he was running around Charlie Brown, I think. And that one actually worked for me because I guess the flow of it was following, my eye was following the flow of it. And here it kind of works against my like as Jim's saying, the left to right read.
Yeah. This might be one of the disadvantages of cartooning. I mean, cartooning can do a lot that no other medium can, but quick motion doesn't always work.
Yeah.
The right cartoonists can make it happen if they find their own language. Someone like Bill Watterson, we talked about, he can certainly do it. Mm-hmm. Or in superhero comics, Carmine Infantino would come up with some ways to show speed that work. But yeah, in this instance, I think it would have been easier just to go with Snoopy looking off the thing and keep the body the same as it is if he's lying on his back, but just don't do the double head thing. That's hard, those double takes. The master of that is actually Dave Sim in Cerebus. He can do double takes and weird, hand motions and stuff that all are contained in one panel. Uh-huh. And it's actually a lot in a really illustrative style, but it feels like motion.
Okay, I have a question. Are we always looking at the same side of the doghouse? Because if you flipped it, then you'd be seeing the head looking up first.
Right. The dog, it seems like the supper dish is always on the left, right? So I guess that does mean we're always looking at it, at least when the supper dish is there, from the same side.
Yeah, that's maybe interesting. That's why. I always thought we were looking at it from the same side, but I guess that doesn't have to be true, but I always thought it was true.
All right, well, that's a lot about supper dishes and... double takes and comic strips.
Got some more supper dish.
I just want to say, kids out there, if you want to be a freelance cartoonist, that strip is exactly what it's like, except instead of food in the supper dish, it's payment from your clients. And well, usually it's rats.
For me, when I started doing my self-published comic, Strange Attractors, in the 90s, the fact that I was doing a comic at all was just mind-boggling, because before then you couldn't even self-publish. And for me, it was going to the mailbox every morning because I wanted a letter, which would make me a real cartoonist. And so I'd wait, the mail might be here. No. And I remember getting a letter. The first letter was like, oh, my God, I'm a cartoonist. Somebody wrote me.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah. I got a letter from one of my readers that says, thank you for your comic book. It does not suit my present needs. So, well, at least you went out of the way to, tell me that.
Oh, man. January 14th, 3 or 4 is talking to Charlie Brown, who is feeding Snoopy a big bowl of dog food in his dish.
That's 3, by the way.
3. It's 3?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so 3 says to Charlie Brown, I've always been sort of afraid of dogs. Charlie Brown says, as Snoopy is chowing down on the food, well, if you don't want to get bitten, just don't bother a dog while he's eating. 3 and Charlie Brown walk away, and Charlie Brown continues, saying, and whatever you do, don't get involved in a dog fight. Snoopy returns to eating, but thinks to himself, in fact, don't even go near a loud discussion.
Okay, now that's
good advice.
Two bites in January already. 2 references to biting, dogs biting people.
Maybe Schultz got bit by a dog. And now he's having second thoughts. You know what's weird about the drawing in this one? And this is, again, back to Schultz and the brilliance of him being able to pick an iconic picture. Only this time, after a zillion times of watching Snoopy eat at the dog dish, did I notice that the ears just stick out off the back, as opposed to draping as if they would, with actual gravity. But if that was drawn that way, it wouldn't look right, right? It would cover part of his face or maybe his eye.
Yeah, the liberties he takes with ears, it's pretty amazing and cool. And it's inspiring to me as a cartoonist to see, you know, yeah, you draw it for what reads and what makes sense for the comic, not for reality.
Well, you know, that brings up another thing that I was thinking about. I was reading an interview recently, and that's the complete, was it Charles Schulz Conversations, and where they just have a bunch of interviews reprinted, and he's talking, he's doing his bit where he says, you know, my characters are like my little repertory company, right? Mm-hmm. And I can move them around and have them fit any needs. And I started thinking, that's actually, he says that so often, maybe that is more of a key to his creativity than we think about. And what I mean by that is, you know, a repertory company in real life would be a group of actors that can play different roles, right? But the actors are also the characters. So he's not looking at it as, I will create this Peanuts world and I will populate it with these characters. But rather, I have these characters slash actors that are so well developed on their own, I can assemble them in basically any situation and make it work. You know, I think that's how we get to things like the Snoopy adventure strips, where he's just thinking it as, okay, if I was going to make an adventure strip, how would I use my repertory company to fill it out?
Well, you obviously you pull three out of your quiver.
Wait, why? I don't even get it.
The character three.
Oh, the three characters.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's like a golf, more like a golf bag. It's your three iron.
No,
wood. Your wood. What is it?
Oh.
No, but there's some truth in that, because he's phasing out characters who just aren't fitting the bill. He needed a Frida type character for certain situations.
Right.
And Patty couldn't do it.
And he's really nailing those characters when they come along for the most part. You know, this 3-4-5 thing doesn't quite pan out as well as he thought. But I love that they somehow achieve immortality by being in the Christmas special, even though they're like among the most minor characters.
Well, and he seems embarrassed about their names after the first week. He never doesn't want to mention them if he can help it for a while, you know?
Well, it's so funny, Kat, and I think I've mentioned this before, because he says, oh, I'm not a fan of going after the funny name, yet he does it again and again and again.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Well, it's low-hanging fruit, right? You know?
I guess it seems beneath him, though. It really does. And he says it's beneath him.
It is.
He does it.
He doesn't use funny names that much. I mean, Joe Slobotnik. But in those days, there are a lot of like Polish baseball players, like Ted Klazuski and guys like that.
Pigpen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot.
Those are nicknames, though. Those are nicknames.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the character is its funny name. I think that's what I mean. But anyway. January 17th. Charlie Brown and Lioness are standing outside with Snoopy. Snoopy's not apparently paying attention, but Charlie Brown says to Lioness, have you ever heard of a diatryma? He was a bird who stood 7 feet tall and had a head as large as that of a horse. He had a huge, sharp bill and powerful legs with which he could run down small animals. Charlie Brown is saying this to Lioness. Lioness looks shocked. Snoopy's ears are shut skyward in complete panic. Charlie Brown continues by saying, he is now extinct. In fact, he hasn't been around for 60 billion years. In the last panel, Snoopy, looking a bit shaken, thinks to himself, and we don't miss him a bit.
And there's another bite reference from January.
Look at this. Maybe one of his kids got bitten by something out on the Sebastopol ranch. There's like cougars walking, or I don't know what goes on. But I want to point out, again, choices that Schulz makes that I think other cartoonists maybe wouldn't have made. But in this case, I really think this works. So Snoopy is to the left of Charlie Brown and Lioness, who are having this conversation. And in the second panel, it takes up, almost two-thirds of the panel, just that long description of the diatryma or whatever, diatryma. And it's interesting because you have to read through six lines of dialogue from Charlie Brown before you look at the image, theoretically, if you're going from left to right, top to bottom. So he has Snoopy's response the first thing you see on the left. And I think that's really interesting because theoretically Charlie Brown's speaking first. And I think some cartoonists would put Snoopy to the right. But he put Snoopy to the left. And I think this is where Charles Schulz absolutely masters the deadpan Snoopy with the ears straight up.
Uh-huh.
He does it just a couple strips back at the very beginning, what we did here, but his ears are a little angled, I guess because Charlie Brown is blocking where his ear would go in this
right.
one. But I think he's just the perfect little deadpan, you know, you don't show it on the outside except for your ears give you away kind of look. I love that. I think it's so cool. And his expression in the last panel is priceless, where he's let down from, oh, he's relieved, but at the same time, he's like, oh, man, I don't want to ever see one of those things.
Yeah. Well, Harold, I don't want to turn this into a huge conversation, but I don't think people read the words first and then look at the picture.
That's interesting.
I think I maybe get kind of a gestalt of the panel. Like, move my eyes around and then read it.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I tend to. Well, I know in this case, I was reading the text in the, you know, in the periphery. I could kind of see what's going on, but I didn't really get the humor of the expression on Snoopy when I really focused on it until I was done reading. But yeah, I mean, people are different.
Yeah, well, I think this should be a huge conversation because why not? You know, I don't know. One of the things I think in the context of a gag cartoon, like for the New Yorker, I think you have to look at the picture first and then read the caption, right? Because if you read the caption and then look at the picture, all you'll notice is that, oh, yes, that confirms what the caption says.
But if you see the picture first.
The picture has to be a mystery.
Yeah, if the picture's on top of the caption, I don't know who's going to read the caption first. Because it's just so much more, it's grabbing your eye and it's on top, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's designed for exactly what you're saying. So no one gets it out of order.
Well, as long as we're talking about stuff that is just completely esoteric and inside baseball, Scott McCloud defines comics as pictorial and other images juxtaposed in deliberate sequence, right? And then he goes on and say, so therefore a New Yorker comic strip is not a comic because it's not juxtaposed. It's only one image. But since the definition says pictorial, and there's a picture, and other images, and there's letters, and they're separated, and thus juxtaposed, I'd just like to point out here on this podcast that Scott McCloud is completely wrong.
That's blasphemy.
So you're saying that the letters are images?
Yeah. Because he, by his definition, the letters are images.
So, okay. Well, I hear what you're saying. Like, we'll have Scott on to defend himself.
Yeah, I don't actually really care. It's, by the way, the best book ever written about comics. So don't let that sway you.
We're just trying to prod him. Come on to the show, Scott.
Oh, I would love that. I mean, no, he is one of my all-time faves. I love Scott McCloud.
He's great.
I love Zot before understanding comics. So. Hey, so we were at the beginning of this saying, well, I think we might actually be able to get through this episode relatively quickly. And I notice we are now 30 minutes into it, and we are in January. So what we're going to do is take a quick break. So when we do that, you guys can pause it, and you could go and go to unpackingpeanuts.com, and you can sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread, where you'll start getting email from us. You haven't gotten them yet because we were working out some technical glitches, but that's starting. It should already have started by the time you are listening to this. If you haven't fired up your gocomics.com, you can do that. And otherwise, we'll just be back right after I play this, which is the correct pronunciation of whatever that bird was called. We'll all learn it together right now.
Diatryma.
Hi, everyone. I just want to take a moment to remind you that all three hosts are cartoonists themselves, and their work is available for sale. You can find links to purchase books by Jimmy, Harold, and Michael on our website. You can also support the show on Patreon or buy us a mud pie. Check out the store link on unpackingpeanuts.com.
And we're back. Did you miss us? I missed you. We're still in January, so let's get back to it. January 22nd, Charlie Brown and Snoopy are at the top of a hill. Charlie Brown is carrying his sled behind him. He says to Snoopy, "This is a steep hill, Snoopy." They both sit down on Charlie Brown's sled. Then Charlie Brown says to Snoopy, "But we're not afraid, are we? We know that no matter what dangers lie ahead, we can face them if we stick together." Then in the last panel, Snoopy casually pushes Charlie Brown down the hill alone with his rear paw, sending Charlie Brown flying and his hat flying off Charlie Brown's head.
So this is hostility.
Can we agree on that? Give him a nice push, you know?
I don't think it's hostility because they're going together. But Snoopy's like, you still go. That's fine. You do you. But you talked me out of it. I think it's Charlie Brown's fault for talking so much about it.
Here's another technical question in terms of, well, it's more of an artistic choice. We see Charlie Brown and Snoopy looking down the mountain to the left instead of to the right. And so when Snoopy kicks him off the mountain, Charlie Brown is going off to the left instead of to the right. Why did Charles Schulz choose to do it that direction rather than in the direction we are reading the strip?
It might be as prosaic as he had to put the word balloon where it went in the first panel because of the block of peanuts text with the logo.
But if you think about it, if you flip it, you wouldn't have to move that one bit. Yeah, he could
have. Oh, that's true. No, you wouldn't have to move that one bit. Maybe it is either a conscious or subconscious decision to go intentionally against the flow of the reader so that you feel Snoopy pushing it. You know, you're forced to suddenly bounce
back. That's kind of...
with those
That's kind of what I'm thinking, because I think it was C.C. Beck who used to do the Captain Marvel. He was all about clarity, and one of the things he said is if you wanted to add tension to the comic, have the characters go in the opposite direction that you're reading, and that creates some sort of a tension. It's more jarring if you do that.
It's very funny that you should mention this, because I'm working on this personal project, this depression book I think I've mentioned on here, and it all builds up towards this sort of two-page spread that I finished just last week. And I spent the two-page spread is basically exactly trying to achieve this, and I needed to, something goes on in the background, something comes in either from the left going right or from the right going left, and I actually had to think about it for like 25 minutes before I decided that I wanted to do exactly what Schulz is saying and have the thing come in the opposite direction so that it does interrupt the reader's flow. Because it specifically had to feel like an impact.
Right, right. And I think that really does, that's not just theory. I think that actually does work. And the one other thing I really love in this strip is the third panel of Snoopy considering what Charlie Brown's saying, that we're sticking together through thick and thin. And Snoopy's nose is not where it normally should be. It's like moved away from Charlie Brown as if he's already distancing himself, but just his nose. It's just shifted a little bit on the snout away from Charlie Brown.
Yeah. It's almost as if you could see his mouth. You would see it like kind of off to one side, like, I don't know, which also sort of has that feel in the last panel too, even though
that's a classic. Yeah.
Even though there's no mouth at all, a classic. And we have seen him do something similar like this to Linus.
It's worth redoing. It's funny every time.
Oh, it is funny. Every time. Absolutely. January 27th. This is part of a long sequence. And this is actually one of my favorite sequences. And I remember this a lot as a kid. What it is Lucy has decided to help Charlie Brown out at the psychiatry booth by giving him a presentation of all of his faults, which she has prepared as a slideshow. So in this particular one, she is beginning to show the slides to Charlie Brown. So we see her setting up the slide projector. It's her and Charlie Brown and the slide projector. And she says, "Okay, turn off the lights." Panel 2 is completely black. Then in panel 3, the slide projector starts up, illuminating Charlie Brown and Lucy. And Lucy says, "Now, this afternoon, Charlie Brown, we're going to be looking at slides which deal with your many personality faults. Some of them are quite shocking. Take this one, for instance." Charlie Brown says, "Ugh!" Then Lucy says, "Easy, easy. This is only the beginning."
Yeah, this is one of the great sequences. And we probably should have picked the whole thing.
I do, at some point, I want to do that. We have to figure a way. We don't want to read all the strips because we don't want to infringe on Mr. Schultz's copyright. We're trying to, you know, add a discussion and scholarship to the mix. But I do think it'd be really important to, at some point, find a really long one and look at it in depth. This is a great one, though.
Oh, it's brilliant. And part of the thing that makes it so funny is the fact he doesn't show the slides, and he couldn't possibly show the slides.
Right.
Because there's no way he can show a side of a personality fall.
That's true. Yeah. Boy, Schultz's craft is just jumping out of me in every single one of these. He is at the top of his game. So as Jimmy described it, Lucy says, turn out the lights. And then the next panel, there is nothing but black. The lights have been turned out. And then when she has the thing back on, we see them from the side as Lucy goes through an incredibly long dialogue. He could have used the second panel to break that up, but I think it's genius that he has that black panel in panel two.
It is total genius. Total genius. And there's so much black ink on this strip, it looks like it could be a Dick Tracy strip. I love it. Especially because he's not messing it up with his whiteout stars in the background. It's just pure black because we're inside. The characters look great against it. And, you know, this goes again to what William Pepper was saying all those weeks ago. Lucy's trying to help in some way.
Yeah, yeah. And for those of you who have not read this before, little spoiler that she ultimately does send Charlie Brown a bill for $143. And when she breaks it down and itemizes it, she spent some money on this. And she's trying to cover some of her costs.
Now, I believe $100 was her personal
fee. Right, but $43 for Lucy to spend on Charlie Brown's faults for the slides and renting the projector is, I mean, that's dedication.
That absolutely is. You know, one of the things I've said is that sometimes I feel like the wrap-up of these long stories sometimes doesn't land for me. This one just does. When it gets through the way to you get my bill, and it just it slowly shifts from this, I've shown you all your faults, to this is how much your bill is. Hey, I'm not going to pay that. And at every level of it's funny and character driven and really good. I really encourage everyone to go out and read this entire sequence. February 9th. Linus is sitting inside and he's playing with some Lincoln logs, putting together a little toy log cabin. Then suddenly, all his hair shoots up and off his head, and he looks at his hand and says, "A sliver!" He yells to the sky, "Ugh, I got a sliver! I got a sliver in my finger!" He continues as Lucy comes over, saying, "Let's see." Linus pulls his hand away from her, yelling, "Don't touch it! Don't touch it!" Lucy, walking away, says, "I'd better go get a pair of tweezers." Linus is now standing on top of what looks like a kitchen stool and yelling, "No, no, it'll hurt. You'll kill me. You'll kill me." Lucy comes over with her tweezers, looking annoyed, and says, "Look, you want to get the sliver out, don't you? Well, hold still." In the next panel, we see Lucy performing her operation while Linus looks about ready to faint. Then in the next panel, Linus pulls his hand back again and says, "Wait a minute. Didn't we forget something?" Then in the final panel, he says to Lucy, "While you're operating, I thought I was supposed to be biting on a bullet."
This strip means a lot to me right now because I have a splinter and I'm trying to ignore it.
Oh, no.
And now it's getting infected.
Well, pull it out.
No, it'll hurt. It'll hurt.
I'm going to fly go over right now.
She's got to get, Liz is going to have to do it and give me like an injection of morphine or something.
So Michael,
well, remember, no sliver is so big or so complicated that it can't be run away from.
Well, if you just wait 10 years, it will dissolve.
By the way, speaking of it, you just called it a splinter, right? This is to me one of those weird Schultz things. I've never heard anyone else call it a sliver.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's like tricks or treats.
Yeah.
I love the drawings of Linus yelling, of course. The big black mouth in these characters works great. But my favorite is Linus on top of the tiny little kitchen stool. I love whenever Schultz has to draw something from our real world and he actually tries to make it look like something from the real world, because he always does it perfectly. And in the most minimal way possible. It's just a great kitchen chair, like at an island or something.
Yeah, that should be a fridge magnet, just that one panel. Well, Michael, I hope your sliver resolves itself without any issues.
Well, I'm probably going to put it off for another week or two till it gets really, really horrible.
The calls I've had with Michael, he'd say, well, the orders for the new comic came in, and be like, oh, well, what are they? He's like, I don't know, I haven't looked. When did they come in? 5 days ago. Like, oh, boy.
If you don't look, it doesn't exist. That's my theory.
By the way, I don't think biting on the bullet was real. You bit on a leather strap, right? I don't think anyone actually bit
a
bullet. I think that's just I believe that's a malapropism. Not a malapropism,
it's the opposite of an urban myth. It would be more like a frontier myth.
Frontier myth, yeah, right.
Or maybe they all knew in the frontier that you didn't bite on a bullet. So maybe you're right.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Just an urban myth.
All right. February 11th, Snoopy, pretending he's keeping to himself but is actually up to something, watches as Linus walks by. As Linus crosses Snoopy, Snoopy gets up and kicks him in the butt. Then Snoopy sprints away from Linus, who finds him, but he can't do anything because Snoopy has run directly to the Humane Society.
With the smuggest look on his face you'd ever would see. Oh,
and the most annoyed looking Linus.
There's every single drawing in this. This is a perfection strip. It's just so well done.
Is this like total aggression? Yes.
Yeah, Snoopy's enjoying it. I'm telling you, I love the little boot.
Yeah, well,
with the serif fonts.
But he's smiling, so he's not really being aggressive. I mean, yes, it's annoying, Linus, but we'd say, oh, he's just getting him going. This was basically the constant state of childhood, right? For me, was everybody constantly, everybody's trying to get each other's goats constantly. No, not yet. I would kick occasionally. I mean, whatever, they throw a baseball, things happen. That's an in-joke, people, forget it. You didn't hear it here. February 16th. Charlie Brown is reading a piece of paper, and he says, very interesting. Linus, overhearing this, says, what's very interesting? Then Charlie Brown says to Linus, listen, these are words to parents from Dr. Horwich. Charlie Brown continues reading. This is a quote from Dr. Horwich. If homework is to be beneficial to a child, it should not consist of assignments imposed as a punishment for behavior totally unrelated to the work assigned. Linus agrees and says, that's good thinking, Dr. Horwich. You're a gem. Charlie Brown continues, the child who is tardy in arriving at school should not have to read an extra 20 pages at home as punishment for such behavior. Linus says, that's what I say. Charlie Brown continues, children in elementary schools should not be given assignments, all of which combined will take longer than 1 hour to complete. Linus, hear, hear, as he points to the sky. Charlie Brown, the child should not be asked to spend the entire time between dinner and bedtime doing homework. Linus, pounding the table, says, amen, how right can you get? Charlie Brown continues, whenever there is homework, there must be a three-member team, the teacher, the child, and the parent. Linus, arms folded across his chest, says, I fully agree, then shouts to the heavens, let the principal keep out of it, sending Charlie Brown flying. Charlie Brown, lying on the ground, smiling, says, it's not often that a person gets the chance to read to someone who shows such enthusiasm.
Who is this Horwich guy? He sounds like a communist to me.
He's my hero. I agree with all of that. I remember when my daughters were in sixth grade, they would have like three and a half hours worth of homework a night in sixth grade.
Well, Dr. Horwich is actually real. This is Dr. Frances Horwich, and she was the lady who was the host of Ding Dong School, which he mentioned. Miss Frances is the other way he referred to Horwich.
Miss Frances coming back, getting more appearances than
Over how much of a period of time? I mean, there's a lot of love for Dr. Horwich here. So, yeah, she was syndicated through like 1965. She ran for over a decade. So she was a part of Schultz's life, apparently, and he liked her a lot from what we can tell in these strips. I just love this stuff with Linus. He's just totally getting into it. I love him pounding on the table and the little mid-century modern lamp is bounced off of it. It's just great. And the little cord for the lamp, which is curling itself down to the plug-in areas. I remember this one as a kid.
The little TV details, the little couch.
Yeah, in fact, showing the TV, I think, is a little nod to Dr. Horwich too. That you see the TV, since that's how Linus and Charlie Brown would see Miss Frances, would be on the TV. So he's even stuck that in there. And unless that's the washing machine, and I take it all back. But I remember this as a kid.
I completely agree with Miss Frances and Linus. I think that all makes sense. March 1st, it's a long line of kids going up to a ticket booth. The kids in the line are Violet, Linus, Charlie Brown, Patty, Lucy, Schroeder, 5, 3, and 4.
That's right. That's correct.
Charlie Brown says to Linus, "I shouldn't be here," while way up at the front of the line, 4 says, "One, please." Boy, that's confusing. Then Charlie Brown says to Linus, to no one in particular, "I should get out of line and go home." Then Charlie Brown continues as the line gets closer and closer to the ticket booth. Charlie Brown says, "I feel guilty about going to the show today. I should be home helping my mother." 5 now says, "One, please." Charlie Brown continues talking to Linus. "I have schoolwork to do, too. I have a book report to write and about 10 pages of arithmetic." Schroeder, "One, please." Charlie Brown continues, "I really shouldn't be going to the show. I feel awfully guilty about it. I should go home." Lucy, "One, please." Charlie Brown continuing, "I can't really enjoy a show when I feel guilty about going to it. I should just get out of line and go back home." Patty says, "One, please." Now Charlie Brown is at the front of the line and he says, "One, please." Now Linus is at the front and he says, "Good old wishy-washy Charlie Brown. One, please."
Shermie doesn't even get to say one, please.
That's what depressed me. We only see him in the last panel and a half.
Let's check the Shermometer, Charlie Brown.
So now we can say Shermie is a straggler.
Oh, see, there you go. It adds to
or a latecomer. I don't know. What do you think is the right?
Well, I like straggler because latecomer, I mean, he was there at the beginning.
Well,
so
we don't know
away. Oh, well, the beginning of our
the beginning of our strip. I thought you meant the beginning of
the
this strip.
But yeah, not. Oh, no. He clearly was a latecomer to the show.
I wonder if he even has a quarter to pay for his. He's going to bum it off of Frida.
Yeah, not from his royalties, certainly, at this point. But if we agree that he is a straggler, that would make Shermie, as of 1964, a straggling, bystanding, cynical, philosophical, history-loving, empathetic, aggressive, compassionate, patient, pedantic, knowledgeable, emotional, good-listening, vain, friendly, hypocrite.
Boy, I envy the kids that they could. All these kids are just able to freely walk down to a movie theater and go see a show. I was like, wow. When I was a little kid, I remember reading this as a little kid, going, you know, even if they're standing in line to get the candy bar, free candy bar, and Charlie Brown doesn't get the free candy bar, I'm still like, but yeah, he's going to a show. He just could walk down and see a show at the local theater. I thought, well, how cool would that be?
That particular one, the one where he isn't there in time to get the candy bar, it's like 1,500 kids, the first 1,500. I remember thinking that there aren't 1,500 people in my whole city. In my whole city, Girardville, I think at that point probably had 2,400 people. There certainly weren't 1,500
kids. Apparently there are 1,500 kids in Hennepin County.
Oh, my God. So he uses this line of kids things quite often from here on in, doesn't he?
Yeah.
They're memorable.
Well, I don't know about quite often, but certainly they're all memorable and certainly several times. I love it when just the visual joy of seeing all the characters in like one panel is really cool. March 22nd, Schroeder in full catcher gear is out on the field and he says, "Hey, manager, we have a problem." Charlie Brown in his manager gear standing by the bench says, "I'm used to that." Schroeder comes up holding Snoopy's supper dish to Charlie Brown and says, "We're missing second base today, so I thought we could use Snoopy's dish." Charlie Brown says, "I guess that'll do all right for practice." Then in the next panel, we see Linus smacking the ball a good one and rounding first, only to come face to face with a growling, snarling Snoopy, protecting his water dish, and thus runs back to first. Now, in the next sequence, we see Five, who also gives the ball a ride, runs past first, goes to second, only to be greeted by a growling, snarling Snoopy, and he too runs back to first. Charlie Brown says, "This is going to be one of those days when we get nothing but singles."
Now, Snoopy hasn't exhibited this behavior as a second baseman before. Is it the dish?
It's the dish.
It's the dish.
You sure it's the dish?
It's the,
of course it's the dish.
But it's an empty. It's an empty dish, though.
Yeah, but he doesn't want. Do you want people putting their feet in your food dish?
Sure.
And secondly, I think we can kind of say maybe Charlie Brown isn't all at fault, because Linus not only runs back to first, he must run home, because if Five comes up next, Linus would still be on first, right? And now they would both be stuck at. So I think Linus just hauled it and went home. He's like, "Too bad, forget it."
Wow. I love Snoopy's teeth here. They're just they're funny and they're a little bit menacing.
That's a tough thing to do, to draw the opposite emotion, fun, right? You know, I mean, he's drawing something that's supposed to look ferocious and vicious in world, but to us has to look that way, but also look funny.
And adorable.
It's a tough.
But that mouthful of upper teeth is just priceless. It's just like one giant tooth. It's got some crags in it. It's great.
And here's another example. Like, this could have been Schroeder. There's no reason this had to be Five.
You think he's really trying to find his way with these characters and give Three, Four, and Five their due?
It seems to be, but he's not doing it by expanding their personalities like he would do with any of the other characters.
My theory is that Three, Four, and Five represent kids that were coming over to the Sebastopol ranch, that they were just, you know, nice, easygoing kids. You know, they got slightly scraggly hair with the girls and got this kind of crazy crew cut for Five. That's my personal theory, is that, yeah, these are kids that somehow reflect the personalities of the kids that Schultz was seeing on his sprawling ranch estate or whatever.
What's your take on Five, Michael?
I think he's a Shermie substitute.
Which is so weird, though.
This would be a perfect role for Shermie.
A perfect role for Shermie, right? Absolutely.
So Five might be like paying Schultz off or something. He's got a better agent, let's say.
It's nothing old Abe Lincoln couldn't take care of.
Have you met my friend, Mr. Washington?
One, please.
March 29th, and we see our first panel is a framed picture of Charlie Brown smiling with words underneath it saying "our manager." That's on the picture of Charlie Brown. In the next panel, we see Lucy carrying her baseball bat and holding a bag, looks like a sack lunch, and she's walking to the field, where she approaches Schroeder and says, "Here, have a donut." Schroeder says, "Thank you," as he takes a donut from out of Lucy's sack. They're both standing there as they watch Charlie Brown in the foreground, who's managing the baseball team. Lucy says to Schroeder, "I wonder how Charlie Brown ever got to be our manager. None of us has any respect for him." Schroeder says, "I suppose it's a matter of dedication." As he eats the donut, he says to Lucy, "Charlie Brown is the only one who's completely dedicated to baseball. This is what makes a good manager." Then Schroeder concludes his little homily to Lucy, saying, "I think he'd rather manage than eat." Then Lucy walks with her little bag out to Charlie Brown and says, "Here, Charlie Brown, have a donut." Charlie Brown says, "No, thank you. I'd rather manage." Lucy walks back to Schroeder and says, "You're right."
I was thinking Lucy seems to be nicer.
Uh-huh.
She's offering donuts. She was going to help Linus with his splinter. And then I saw the next strip.
April 1st. Charlie Brown is sitting, eating his peanut butter sandwich on his bench in the schoolyard. And Lucy says, "Charlie Brown, that little red-haired girl wants you to come over and eat lunch with her." Charlie Brown walks over out of panel, a look of just, he's overcome with emotion. He's partly afraid. He looks slightly excited too. He's clutching his lunch close to his chest. Lucy watches as he walks away. Then in the last panel, he comes back with a wicked glare on his face. And Lucy says to him, "April Fool."
That is the nastiest thing she's ever done.
It's really bad, especially if you consider what would have happened in that missing panel.
But look right? at that innocent little look on her face when she says April Fool. I don't know that she thinks that's the case. She doesn't know how strongly Charlie Brown feels about the little redhead girl. I don't know. Right. Yeah, Lucy really is changing in front of our eyes here, right? She's growing up. She's the older sister character and has been for quite some time, but there seems to be this kind of air of responsibility attached to her that I don't remember seeing as much. She's often irresponsible in being responsible, but she does seem to be maturing. And it goes back to, I can't remember if it was Amy or Jill saying that they thought for sure Lucy was inspired by Meredith, who's now 14 years old. I'm just wondering if Schultz in any way connects Lucy to somebody who's growing and changing in front of him.
Possibly. Now, you don't think she's trying to help him, do you?
Not in this instance.
I don't know. I mean, no, but I think
to her.
But playing April Fool on someone can mean that you're friends. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that look on her face is just so perfectly innocent and almost just like she's sticking her face. I don't know. There's just something in that look that it does. It just seems so crazily innocent when it's so totally inappropriate that she's clueless. I don't know.
I guess if I were a genius, which I am not, and I wanted to convey that, what you're saying, Harold, I think what I would have done is have it be April Fool? ? Right? Like, because the look I'm seeing on her face is almost like, oh, that was a lot harsher than I thought it would be. You know what I mean? Because if you picture what is happening in that third panel, right? He would have had to go over, talk to the little red-haired girl, say, "Oh, my friend Lucy said you wanted to have lunch with me." And she'd be like, "Oh, what are you talking about?" It would be the worst thing ever. I don't think Lucy thought that much.
I don't think Lucy even thinks that after the fourth panel, she's not an empath in that regard, right? So she sees it
that's
and
true.
She's just like, "Oh, now that went over just like I thought it would." You know, it was fun.
Is there any chance, because she's trying to help him, right, by showing him the slideshow? Mm-hmm. He's never right. talked to the little red-haired girl, and she got him to talk to the little red-haired girl.
That is true.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. That's actually a really good
point. It could
have
gone down well. Yeah, it's true. We don't know.
Well, that's true. You know, the other thing about what we're discussing, Harold, right, with her intent in that last panel, I mean, this is based on unbelievably close reading of infinitesimally small pen yeah. lines and the changes to them.
It is, yeah.
And he's conveying a real subtlety of emotion. It's beautiful cartooning.
The drawing
to see
of Charlie Brown is heartbreaking and priceless and great. Funny all at the same time.
The way you could see him angrily crunching the bag next to him. You know,
because this is one time when Charlie Brown owns his emotion. He's not being wishy-washy Mm-mm. here. He is 100% thinking one thing.
I would like to kill you.
And in a way, that's kind of exhilarating to see him look that way, because he's often so uncertain of himself.
For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question that the characters are growing, that this strip continues to branch out and to deepen. It's just doing all kinds of great stuff. So great that we're going to have to stop for this week. But I really hope you guys come back next week. Because we have, what, 7 more months left of 1964 still to discuss. But until then, what I would really love for you to do is check out our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, right? You could go, you could vote for the strip of the year. You could check out some transcripts that Liz has posted, a little tutorial on how to navigate Go Comics. Obscurities are listed up there. And of course, all the old episodes. You can also find us on social media at Unpack Peanuts on both Instagram and Twitter, and we would love to hear from you. We also started a little Peanuts hotline, so if you want to call, leave a message with a question or a brief comment, you can do that too. You can call us at 717-219-4162. And we would love to hear from you. And yeah, if you have a good question or a great comment, well, we might use it on the show. Other than that, just come back here next week where we're going to continue 1964. Until then, for Michael and Harold, I'm Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes, be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.